The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the AFB Summer Newsletter, the 9to5Mac.com new iOS 16 is getting rid of CAPTCHAs. From MoNews.Bulletin, how to avoid a travel nightmare this summer. From Wired, two articles, The Ghost of Internet Explorer, and Update iOS, Chrome, Windows, and Zoom ASAP. From Tech Explorist, the mechanism behind retinitis pigmentosa has been ID'd. So let's get started. From AFB Communications, focus on AFB Summer 2022. AFB's quarterly focus on AFB is here. Take a look at what we've been up to and what's ahead for the upcoming months. 2022 AFBLC created connections across a diverse array of participants. True to its name of putting inclusion to work, the 2022 AFB Leadership Conference, AFBLC, brought together a diverse array of leaders in the blindness field, major corporations, and accessibility experts. Nearly 300 people attended the AFBLC to learn, share ideas, and network, with an emphasis on how they're working toward greater inclusion. What's more, there were many opportunities for attendees to talk about ways to make even more progress toward achieving that goal. AFB Talent Lab launches with first group of interns and apprentices. There's an increasing demand for fully accessible digital tools, like websites and apps. But finding people with expertise in accessibility isn't quite so easy, because it's rarely taught in computer science education. And if it is, it's usually high level and often expensive. For more than 20 years, AFB has helped companies improve the accessibility of their technology through AFB Consulting, which always believed in building an accessibility from the start rather than patching existing systems. AFB Consulting's skilled team of tech designers, engineers, and project managers worked with countless companies over the years, but AFB wanted to scale our impact. I'm sure they meant scale up. Journey Forward shows the need for continued access improvements. As a follow-up to AFB's Flatten Inaccessibility Report, which studied the impact of COVID on people who are blind, low vision, or deafblind, our research team conducted the Journey Forward survey. In July and August 2021, the team dug deeper into topics identified in the initial study, including digital accessibility barriers, transportation and safety challenges, and access to healthcare, food, and medical supplies. The recently released Journey Forward research report reveals that survey participants continue facing many of the same challenges they did during the Flatten Inaccessibility study, conducted in April 2020. Plus, with the introduction of vaccines and more availability of COVID testing, new issues have come to the surface. Bojana Kokliat, C-O-K-L-Y-A-T. What does the world look like to you? Bojana Kokliat is an artist, disability activist, and former project manager for the New York City Museum Arts and Access Consortium, where she helped ensure that museums and art spaces, including virtual ones, are accessible and welcoming to all people with disabilities. She holds a bachelor's degree in art therapy and a master's degree in disability studies and art administration. She received a Fulbright grant and spent a year researching access in the Czech Republic and their arts and cultural institutions. She's also a consultant and co-producer on Worlds We Live In, a documentary film commissioned by AFB that demonstrates Helen Keller's legacy of advocacy and achievement through the voices of a diverse array of today's blind community. As a visually impaired person on the film production team, she brings her unique perspective and connections to the creative process. News. AFB's commitment to improving digital inclusion was front and center at the 2022 AFB Leadership Conference. There were two panels devoted to the topic, which demonstrated how we're engaging with other organizations in advocacy, the exploration of new communication technology and tools, including those on the near horizon, and making sure laws adapt to ever-changing technology. We had a great opportunity to get the message out to attendees that there has to be a more systemic approach to digital accessibility, says Sarah Malaier, M-A-L-A-I-E-R, Senior Advisor, Public Policy and Research, who participated in the first panel and moderated the second. There's a link to support our mission, and that is it. From 9to5Mac.com, this new iOS 16 feature will rid the web of pesky CAPTCHA verification puzzles. Article by Chance Miller. With the release of iOS 16 this year, Apple is taking steps toward eliminating the need for those pesky CAPTCHAs around the web. A new feature called Private Access Tokens will use a combination of details about your device and your Apple ID to inform a website that you are a legitimate user rather than a robot. In turn, this allows you to completely bypass the CAPTCHA step. No more CAPTCHAs in iOS 16. The feature, which was spotted on Reddit over the weekend and by Apple Insider, was detailed by Apple in a WWDC 2022 session titled Replace CAPTCHAs with Private Access Token. In its explanation to developers, Apple explains, as private access tokens are a powerful alternative that help you identify HTTP requests from legitimate devices and people without compromising their identity or personal information. We'll show you how your app and server can take advantage of this tool to add confidence to your online transactions and preserve privacy. As you should expect from Apple, this process is done with privacy in mind. Servers are a blessing to request tokens using a new HTTP authentication method called Private Token. These tokens are then used as part of a cryptographic process to confirm to the server that the client was able to pass an attestation check. Apple explains that these cryptographic situations are unlinkable, which means servers that receive tokens can only check that they are valid, but they cannot discover client identities or recognize clients over time. Yay, no cookies. The process factors in certificates stored in your iPhone, iPad, or Mac Secure Enclave, then verifies that the Apple ID is associated with those certificates in good standing. Apple notes that companies including Fastly and Cloudflare are already developing support for this new Privacy Pass standard. In fact, both of those companies have already enabled their issuer services. Other companies will be able to sign up later this year through Apple's website. This new automatic verification feature is enabled by default in the first betas of iOS 16, iPadOS 16, and macOS Ventura. You can find it by navigating to your Apple ID settings, choosing Privacy and Security, then looking for the new automatic verification toggle at the very bottom. Apple's user-facing explanation says bypass CAPTCHAs in apps and on the web by allowing iCloud to automatically and privately verify your device and account. Because services like Cloudflare and Fastly have already enabled support for this new Privacy Pass standard, you should already be able to bypass CAPTCHAs on websites and apps that rely on those CDNs. FTC reusing come earning audio affiliate links. From monews.bulletin.com, how to avoid a travel nightmare this summer and when it will get better. Posted Wednesday, June 22nd by Moshe, M-O-S-H-E-H. This Wednesday edition of Mo News would typically only be available to premium paid subscribers. However, because of the high interest in summer travel, we're pausing our paywall and making this premium edition available to all subscribers. Thanks for supporting us by signing up for our premium content here. Good morning. You've seen the headlines, Travel Armageddon, Travel Nightmares, Travel Trouble, need we go on? So this week, we turned to one of the country's leading travel experts to get some concrete answers on what's behind the endless flight delays and cancellations and how to navigate it. In this premium edition of Mo News, we spoke to Peter Greenberg, CBS News travel editor, and a multiple Emmy-winning investigative reporter and producer. Peter tells us why the airlines are so unprepared for this summer's explosion in travel demand, when he thinks things might improve, and if airlines' weather excuses are really legit. His answer might surprise you. He also gives us his best advice for picking a flight that might actually take off on time, when you should book to get the cheapest prices, and what you must do next time you rent a car. Here is his quote of the interview. I think the airlines have always been stupid. That's a problem. It's true. They basically are revenue seekers at the expense of common sense. Scroll down to keep reading. Greenberg is the travel editor for CBS News, where he provides analysis on all things transportation and travel from around the world. He also hosts the public television show, The Travel Detective, and the global television specials, The Royal Tour, in which heads of state provide access to historic landmarks and cultural experiences. A huge thank you to Peter for taking the time to speak with us this week. We hope you'll find it helpful as you plan your summer vacations or decide to wait until fall, as you will hear him advise us. Signed, Mosh and Jill. Moshe Oinonu, O-I-N-O-U-N-O-U. We're coming off a long holiday weekend here in the U.S. There were 20,000 airline delays, thousands of cancellations. It's been clear for a while that Americans were ready to travel this summer like never before. What happened? Peter Greenberg. Well, actually, it's been clear since last year that they were ready to travel before, and they did. The airlines got themselves in a problem because you may remember when they all got federal aid, that federal aid was predicated during the pandemic on them not laying off anybody, not firing anybody. So for a period of many, many months, they flew with a full staff and empty planes. The airlines were looking to raise cash to save money, so they came up with a scheme to offer early buyouts and retirement deals early to their staff. They thought maybe 4% would take them, and about 16% did. It was their opportunity to say, okay, I've done this job, goodbye, see you later. And that included a lot of pilots, so that when travel came roaring back, relatively speaking, in May and June of 2021, the airlines didn't have pilots to fly them. Now, does that mean they've hired a lot of pilots since? They didn't. Why? Because then you had the different variants of COVID. Travel started dropping again. Nobody thought clearly here. The fact is, pent-up demand never left. And when the demand came back, the airlines said, great, there's great demand. Let's schedule everything. So they added all sorts of new routes. I mean, in a given year, how many routes do you think Southwest Airlines pre-pandemic would add? The answer is maybe one. After the pandemic, they added more than 30. JetBlue added 29. Well, guess what? It didn't hold up because they became overscheduled and understaffed. You threw in the demand and everything completely fell apart. And as a result, you had planes delayed and planes canceled. And worse, the TSA was understaffed. So you had chaos at the airport, and I haven't even thrown in the weather yet. So you have the beginning makings of a recipe for a system meltdown before weather even played a part. Mo. So, how did the airlines add routes here? Did they run the numbers and say, do we have enough pilots, or are they literally just kind of flying blind here? PG, they are literally flying blind because scheduling guys weren't talking to the operations guys. It just didn't work. And they saw all this revenue to make, but guess what? They can't get the revenue if they're busy apologizing to people because they slept last night in Charlotte. So, the bottom line here is they then tried to do a little triage. They tried to preemptively cancel flights. That didn't solve the problem. Then they started canceling routes. Remember the 29 routes that JetBlue added earlier in the year? They canceled 27 of them. Right, did that help? Not really. What happened a week and a half ago? American Airlines parked 100 planes. That's about an eighth of their fleet. They parked 100 planes, and they had to admit the reason they did not have pilots to fly them. Now there's one more thing I have to throw into the mix. Fuel prices. So you take all the planes that they parked. Those are mostly regional jets, 50-seaters that fly to cities like Toledo, Ithaca, Islip, New York, Eureka, California, Palm Springs. They park those planes because the fuel costs made them economically unviable. And the crazy part? They also try to keep the pilots they had. They gave them almost a 50% salary bump. So based on the economics of that, even if the planes were 85% full, they couldn't make any money. So they've gotten themselves into a real bind here, and I don't know how they get out. Mo. So, we have staffing shortages, we have pilot shortages, we have weather issues, we have fuel prices. Anything else in the mix here? Also, Peter, it's been a couple of years of COVID. Is there some institutional knowledge that's been lost within the airlines themselves, too? PG. No, I think the airlines have always been stupid. That's the problem. It's true. They are basically revenue seekers at the expense of common sense. You want to talk about shortages? Ground handlers, the guys who work under the wing, right? There are 1.2 million fewer of them globally than there were before the pandemic. We had a situation a week and a half ago where the pilot actually left the cockpit, walked down to the tarmac to help load bags so his plane could possibly leave. Not leave on time, just leave. So there's that problem. Then we have one more thing. We talked about the pilot shortage. Let's talk about flight attendants. You know, at every airline, it's a very tough period of time. The last 10 days of any month, because by that period of time after the first 20 days of any month, and by the way, this predates the pandemic, the flight attendants and pilots have one of two things happen. Either one, they've flown their maximum number of legal hours for that month and they can't fly anymore, or they've flown their minimum number of hours and they don't want to fly anymore. In the past, the airlines had reserves. They had junior pilots and junior flight attendants. They don't have the reserves either, so you're seeing flight after flight canceled. Now, is there a solution to this? Well, it lies with the U.S. Department of Transportation, because you can't expect Congress to do anything in the age of deregulation. Can't happen. There's no passenger bill of rights out there, but there is a Department of Transportation rulemaking. You may remember the famous DOT tarmac delay rule. It went into effect a number of winters ago when so many people were trapped on airport tarmacs for 3, 4, 5, 6 hours at a time with planes going nowhere. Right. It forces them to return back to the gate. PG, right. Well, the DOT made a rule. From that point on, any plane that pushes back from the gate, if they're stuck out there and they don't get back to the gate and get rid of those passengers into the terminal within 3 hours of the time they push back from the gate, they're liable to a fine of $27,500 per passenger. So, with a loaded 737, you're already talking seven figures, and the airlines railed against this and said, "That is terrible, it'll never work." Ask me how many fines have been imposed since that tarmac rule went into effect. How about two? So the thing is, you can do it if you want to. Right, I'll give you another one. Mo, what sort of rule could the Transportation Department impose immediately to try to alleviate some of this? PG, well, let's forget about for the moment that we have a problem. Everything that I've talked about really should have been imposed years ago. It's a mathematical certainty that any runway in the world can only handle about 23 takeoffs an hour, right? You have to taxi to the runway, you have to spool up and you take off, and there's about a 3-minute separation between the next guy who comes in. Well, do the math. 23 is about what you can handle, and that's if the separation is like only 2.5 minutes. So why are airlines allowed to schedule 38 departures at 8 o'clock in the morning? Why are they allowed to schedule 34 departures at 5 in the afternoon? That only means that your flight, if it's deemed on time, is only pushed back from the gate on time. It doesn't mean you're leaving. So why don't they institute a lottery system and basically say, American, you have 8:05, you can schedule a flight at 8:05. United, you got 8:19. Delta, you got 8:09. And if you miss that hit time, you're in the penalty box, right? Guess what? Airlines would not artificially schedule their flight to be competitive. Take a look at airline schedules. How many flights are scheduled to leave at 7:59 or 8 o'clock? Because they all want to appeal to guys like you and me, saying that's the first flight of the day. But if they're all the first flight of the day, we're all delusional. So that's one thing that the DOT could do right now. The second thing to do is employ, enact a rule saying that if you can't get a crew staffed within 45 minutes of departure, your plane, your flight is canceled, meaning you're doing that immediately. You're not going to keep people waiting at the airport knowing that the flight crews are never going to show up anyway and then canceling 3 hours later. It's amazing what those consequences can be, especially if you add financial penalties to them. Look at the tarmac delay rule. It has to happen because in the competitive world of deregulation, there's nobody telling the airlines what they can do. And as a result, they do what they want to do at the expense of the other airlines, at the expense of themselves, not to mention the expense of us. I'm going to stop reading there because this has gone on too long already. From Wired.com, the ghost of Internet Explorer will haunt the web for years. Microsoft's legacy browser may be dead, but its remnants are not going anywhere, and neither are its lingering risks. Article by Lily Hay Newman, posted June 20th. After years of decline and a final wind down over the last 13 months, on Wednesday, Microsoft confirmed the retirement of Internet Explorer, the company's long-lived and increasingly notorious web browser. Launched in 1995, IE became pre-installed on Windows computers for almost two decades. And like Windows XP, Internet Explorer became a mainstay to the point that when it was time for users to upgrade and move on, they often didn't. And while last week's milestone will push even more users off the historic browser, security researchers emphasize that IE and its many security vulnerabilities are far from gone. In the coming months, Microsoft will also disable the IE app on Windows 10 devices, guiding users instead to its next-generation Edge browser, first released in 2015. The IE icon will still remain on users' desktops, though, and Edge incorporates a service called IE Mode to preserve access to old websites built for Internet Explorer. Microsoft says it will support IE Mode through at least 2029. Additionally, IE will still work for now on all supported versions of Windows 8.1, Windows 7 with Microsoft's extended security updates, and Windows Server, though the company says it will eventually phase IE out on these too. 7 years after the debut of Edge, industry analysis indicates that Internet Explorer may still hold more than 0.5% of the total global browser market share. And in the United States, that share may be closer to as much as 2%. I do believe we've made progress, and we probably won't see as many exploits against IE in the future. But we will still have remnants of Internet Explorer for a long time that scammers can take advantage of, says Ronnie Tokuczowski, a longtime independent malware researcher and principal threat advisor at the cybersecurity firm Cofence. Internet Explorer as the browser will be gone, but there are still pieces that exist. For something that's been around as long as IE, backward compatibility is difficult to balance with the desire for a clean slate. We haven't forgotten that some parts of the web still rely on Internet Explorer's specific behaviors and features. Sean Lindersay, Lyndersay, the general manager of Microsoft Edge Enterprise, wrote in an IE retrospective on Wednesday, pointing to IE mode. But he added that there was a real need to start over with Edge, rather than trying to salvage IE. The web has evolved, and so have browsers, he wrote last week. Incremental improvements to Internet Explorer couldn't match the general improvements to the web at large, so we started fresh. Microsoft says it will still support IE's underlying browser engine, known as MSHTML, and it has its eye on versions of Windows still used in critical environments. But Maddie Stone, a researcher for Google's Project Zero vulnerability hunting team, points out that hackers are still exploiting IE vulnerabilities in real-world attacks. Since we began tracking in the wild 0 days, Internet Explorer has had a pretty consistent number of 0 days each year. 2021 actually tied 2016 for the most in-the-wild Internet Explorer 0 days we've ever tracked, even though Internet Explorer's market share of web browsers users continues to decrease, she wrote in April, referring to previously unknown vulnerabilities called 0 days. Internet Explorer is still a ripe attack surface for initial entry into Windows machines, even if the user doesn't use Internet Explorer as their Internet browser. In her analysis, Stone particularly noted that while the number of new IE vulnerabilities Project Zero has detected has remained fairly constant, attackers have shifted over to the years to increasingly target the MSHTML browser engine through malicious files like tainted Office documents. This could mean that neutering the IE application won't immediately change attack trends that are already in motion. Given how difficult it has been to rein in Internet Explorer at all, Microsoft and IE users around the world have certainly come a long way, but for a browser that's supposed to be dead, IE is still very much loads with the living. I will postpone reading the Wired.com article on updating iOS, Chrome, Windows, and Zoom, and move on to Tech Explorist. Scientists identified a molecular mechanism that causes blindness, posted June 17th. Retinitis pigmentosa is a degenerative eye disease characterized by progressive vision loss, usually leading to blindness. Inherited retinal degeneration due to the loss of photoreceptor cells is a leading cause of human blindness. While structural defects of the photoreceptor cells associated with retinal degeneration have been observed, the molecular mechanisms involved are not understood. Scientists from the University of Geneva, UNIGE, in collaboration with the University of Lausanne, UNIL, have identified a molecular mechanism that causes degeneration of the eye's photoreceptors, which can lead to blindness. They identified the essential role played by a molecular zipper formed by four proteins. The absence of this zipper leads to cell death in retinal cells. The retina's specialized neuronal cells are responsible for converting light into nerve signals. The light-sensitive pigments are positioned on stacks of discs that make up the cell's outer segment. The connecting cilium connects the inner and outer segments, containing all the metabolic machinery required for cell operation. Mutations in the genes of four proteins located in this connecting cilium are all associated with retinal pathologies, presenting degeneration of photoreceptors. Scientists identified these proteins, which are located in centrioles, cylindrical structures made of microtubules, and present in all animal cells. Virginie Hamel, H-A-M-E-L, the last author of the study, said, in the centriole, these proteins ensure the cohesion of the different microtubules by acting like a zipper. We wondered if they did not play the same role in the tubular structures of the connecting cilium. Using this, the scientists could observe retinal tissue with a resolution never achieved. The biologists focused on the structure of connecting cilia from mice that had or did not have a mutation in the gene for one of the four mentioned proteins. These observations were conducted at different life stages. Olivier Mercier, M-E-R-C-E-Y, a researcher in the Department of Molecular and Cellular Biology and the first author of the study, said, in the absence of the mutation, we found that these proteins ensure, just as we had previously seen in centrioles, the cohesion between microtubules by forming a zipper that closes as development proceeds. When the gene for this protein is mutated, however, the structure of the microtubules initially appears normal, but the microtubules gradually become less and less connected to each other. In adulthood, the affected mice's microtubules are no longer zipped together and finally collapse, resulting in photoreceptor cell loss. Concludes Paul Guichard, G-U-I-C-H-A-R-D, co-author of the study, said, by injecting the protein into patients suffering from certain types of retinitis pigmentosa, we can imagine that the molecular zipper could be restored to ensure the structural integrity of the microtubules of the connecting cilia, thus preventing the death of photoreceptor cells. We are evaluating this approach in collaboration with our colleagues from UNIL and the Jules Gonin Ophthalmic Hospital, Ivan Arsenijevic, and Corinne Kostich. Arsenijevic is spelled A-R-S-E-N-I-J-E-V-I-C, and Kostich is spelled K-O-S-T-I-C. The study has led to a better understanding of the molecular and structural level of retinitis pigmentosa, which allows us to consider treatments that act upstream of cell degeneration. Journal reference, number one, Olivier Mercier, Corinne Kostich et al. The connecting cilium inner scaffold provides a structural foundation that protects against retinal degeneration. DOI 10.1371/journal.pbio.300.1649. Well, I've run out of time for today's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next week. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doris Hyde reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.